What are you doing right now?
Hi, my name is Jeannie Rim, and I'm in Detroit, Michigan, and I'm driving to work at a soup kitchen.
Hi, I'm Madge Rosenberg. I'm baking croissants and bread at Soutine Bakery.
Hi, this is Mark calling from Westport, Massachusetts, and I am very aggravatedly trying to clean up the tea I just spilled on my keyboard.
Hi, my name's Robin. I'm calling from Rochester, Michigan, and I'm in my car on a way to a seminar. Love your show.
Checking in on listeners. Who needs Twitter or Facebook when you have The Takeaway?
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's April the 10th. It's a Friday. Thank goodness for that. I'm Femi Okeh, John Hockenberry, and Adora Udoji are away. But sitting next to me is the oh-so-gorgeous Todd Swillick. Good morning.
Oh, good morning, Femi. Well, coming up this hour, it's the Thriller in Manila, documenting that ultimate rivalry, Joe Frazier versus Muhammad Ali. We'll talk with Joe Frazier, Smokin' Joe, about that historic fight. We're also checking in on an unusual housing program in Cleveland and one in Miami, helping new homeowners move into foreclosed properties. All this coming up, but first, these headlines.
The president meets with senior economic advisors at the White House this morning to talk about rising unemployment and stress tests put to the nation's biggest banks. He's meeting with the Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner, Fed Chief Ben Bernanke, FDIC Chair Sheila Blair, and others. Also on the agenda, the takeaways from last week's G20 economic summit. President Obama is asking Congress for an additional $83 billion in supplemental funding for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The White House says the cash infusion will get them through September the 30th. The president had promised to end the practice of paying for wars with special funding instead of listing all military spending in the annual budget.
CIA Director Leon Panetta says the agency has stopped using secret overseas prisons to interrogate terrorism suspects. Panetta says those jails have been empty since 2006. He also says the CIA won't use contractors to interrogate suspects anymore. In Italy, there was an open-air funeral mass today for about 200 of the victims of Monday's earthquake. In a message read to thousands of mourners, Pope Benedict told mourners that he shared their anguish and he hoped they would find courage to overcome their grief.
And the ship's captain, held by Somali pirates, is still being held hostage, but there are reports that he tried to swim away last night and was recaptured. The pirate's lifeboat is drifting in the Indian Ocean, where it has run out of fuel. So this morning, Todd, we are asking a very simple question. What are you doing right now, and what's on your mind?
I'm working on cooking breakfast for my daughter, thinking about how sort of odd it is that Christians refer to this as Good Friday.
I'm sitting at work. I get here every morning at 6 o'clock and listen to you guys at Newark Airport.
I'm in the harbor, watching the sun come up.
It's all part of our continuing experiment. Join in 1-877-8-MY-TAKE on mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Hello there, I'm Femi Okeh with Todd Swillick with you this morning. Now, as foreclosure rates across the nation skyrocket to record-breaking levels, the image of a boarded-up home is becoming a more common feature on many landscapes. This morning, we were inspired by our partner, The New York Times. They have a story in Today that focuses on organizations who are getting people back into their homes for free. Joining us on the line is Max Rimeau. He is part of a grassroots organization called Take Back the Land, and it places homeless families in houses that are being foreclosed upon. He joins us from Miami, Florida. Morning, Max. Tell us exactly what you're doing and how you do it.
Well, what we do is we identify vacant government-owned and foreclosed homes We scout them. We look at them for, you know, the kind of conditions that they're in. We open them, and we move homeless families into people's homes. We match up those homes with people who don't have anywhere else to stay, and we move them in.
It's quite a calculated process. You even do sort of applications, interviews, some kind of vetting. Tell me more details about that.
Well, we have certain criteria that we have around the homes that we move people into. We only do foreclosed homes. We don't do the homes that are individually owned. They have to be in good condition so that it really is a step up from the street, not like a vertical step. So we have all kinds of rules around the homes that we choose. In addition, we have rules around the families. We interview the families. We do move in families, not individuals. But also, on top of that, we won't move anyone in who has any conditions which could be exacerbated by them being in a home alone. For example, drug addiction or severe mental health issues. We also require the families to keep on the electricity and the water, and we require them to be good neighbors. We tell them they have to say hi to their neighbors. They have to say good morning, good evening. They can't make too much noise, things like that. Because we're trying not only to improve the lives of the individuals who we're moving in, but also of the community into which we're moving them.
You helped a family called the Trody family. I'm just going to listen into a little bit of a clip from Mary Trody. Have a listen to this.
February the 20th, they baked us out. We went to a parking lot of a supermarket, and we slept in the truck. 3 days later, on February the 23rd, they backed the land, brought us back in.
Tell us more about Mary Trody and her situation and how she came to find you.
Well, Mary Trody actually is a longtime community activist. She's been involved in her community for a long period of time. And, of course, a very close-knit family. Her husband lost her job as part of the newspaper's, downsizing. And so as a result, they were kicked out of their apartment while he was out of work for several months. And she moved in with her mother and then her two teenage children, and then her adult daughter. The same thing happened to her family, and they moved in as well. So in the meantime, the Trodys were able to both of them find work. Her husband found her work again with another newspaper, or with the same newspaper, and she found work working night shifts at a grocery store. And yet Mary's mother lost her home to a fraudulent refinance scheme. So she was a victim of fraud. And so they were all kicked out. It was 12 people living in one home. And three separate families, really. But she's a wonderful person, and they're a very close-knit family, and they want to stay close together. And they're just in a tough situation. They're really victims of this time.
Well, Mark, you're moving families like the Trodys into foreclosed homes. What kind of reaction do you get from the banks that own these homes? What have they been saying? What kind of pushback do you get?
Well, we haven't gotten really too much pushback. First of all, we don't announce it to the banks, generally speaking. But however, in certain cases, when the families are found there, such as the Trody's case, where they were actually evicted from the home a few days prior to us moving back into the home, obviously we let the bank know because there was no, at that point, benefit to having them there without knowing. And the police came, they looked around, they asked questions, and the police left. So the Trody's moved into that home in January, and they're there right now.
Max, what you're doing is not legal. You're basically organizing squatting. What laws are you breaking?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know. I certainly don't want to give legal advice here or on the radio. But our primary concern to take back the land is not so much what is legal and illegal, but what is moral and immoral. And there's plenty of times in this country it would have been illegal for me as a black person to do all kinds of mundane things, including sit at a certain place on a bus or eat at a inside of a restaurant rather than the back parking lot. So we think that the laws do not always keep up with the times or with the moral imperatives of the time. And I think this is just one of those cases where we have laws which are protecting banks that are getting billions of dollars of bailout money from the people who don't have anywhere to live. So this doesn't make sense in any respect. And we think that homes, houses, should be primarily and fundamentally for human beings, not as profit centers for corporations. And we think we need to see that shift in people's minds, and then a shift in public policy, and ultimately a shift where this kind of thing is either legal or not needed.
Max Rameau from Take Back the Land. I'm going to move a little bit further away to Northeast Ohio to talk to Brian Davis from the Coalition for the Homeless. Good morning, Brian. Are you there?
Yes, good morning.
Now, you're doing something quite similar to Max, but you're trying to do it legally. What's your plan for Cleveland?
Well, we have about 10,000 abandoned houses in Cleveland, and we're having about 1,000 foreclosures per month. So we actually have about three times the number of houses than we have homeless people. We're trying to just pilot a project to take a few of those houses before they get destroyed, before the wrecking ball comes in, provide them to homeless people who have some skills, who can fix up the property, and then eventually they would be turned over to them after they meet housing quality standards.
Now, you're trying to do this legally, trying to get some money together. How much money do you need for your project?
Well, we're just going to pilot something, so we figure that we need about $150,000 to put the major systems back in the house and then have the homeless do the other parts of the renovation.
What are the pitfalls here for you along the way? Because you haven't done it yet. So what are going to be the issues for you, the challenges for getting this done? It makes good sense for people who don't have homes, but are you getting any pushback?
Well, it's an innovative process, and so most of the thinking right now is, why don't we just clear the land, destroy the buildings, and then start fresh? And most of the pushback from the banks are, you know, we don't want to damage our assets that we have. Even though they're sitting vacant and they're not being used, they want to try to clear them off their books as fast as possible. So we're trying to, you know, just show that this can work on a larger scale. Can we just be given a chance to do it on a small scale?
Well, Max, in Miami, let me ask you, you're listening to this. You're listening to Brian. What do you think of the strategy that he's using up in Cleveland?
I think it's a wonderful strategy. I think we need to use all the strategies possible to put human beings back into housing. I do think, given the – this seems to be a common sense approach to it. It seems like everyone wins in this, and yet it's not happening. And the reason it's not happening, of course, is because the banks want to make as much profit as they possibly can at the end of this economic cycle. So as long as we still have a need for some of these other ways of doing things, then we're going to, you know, people are going to continue to do them. So just so it's clear, while we're doing this kind of in an organized fashion, squatting right now is rampant throughout the country, particularly in Ohio. So I think what Brian's doing is great and needs to be done, but clearly it's not eating up all the space.
Max, I'm going to bring into our conversation, you mentioned the national perspective, and for that, just to wrap us up, Michael Stoops. He's the executive director of the National Coalition for the Homeless. So good morning to you, Michael. What Max is doing in Miami and what Brian is hoping to do in Cleveland, how widespread is this organized squatting around the country?
What Max and Brian are doing in both Miami and Cleveland are like role models for the rest of the country. There are individuals and activist groups like Take Back the Land in other cities around this country that are doing exactly what is happening in Miami, and that's something that we very much support. 44% of the nation's homeless are unsheltered, and we need to get homes for all of our homeless individuals.
Michael, if people are interested in trying to get into a home for free, what advice would you give them? How do they get in touch with you?
I would get in touch with the National Coalition for the Homeless. Our website is nationalhomeless.org, and we can put them in touch with folks like Brian in Cleveland or Max in Miami or in cities nationwide. Squatting is definitely a trend. It's happening, and we must find homes for our nation's homeless.
Michael Stoops is the executive director of the National Coalition for the Homeless. Thanks for joining us this morning, Michael. Also on the line, we have Brian Davis, the executive director for the Northeast Ohio Coalition for the Homeless. And at the very top, we had Max Rameau with the Take Back the Land campaign. Thank you very much indeed, Max, Brian and Michael. You are listening to The Takeaway with Femi Okeh and Todd Zwillick. Todd, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing very well. I can tell you what I'm doing.
Oh, yes.
Which is sitting across from you.
Very slinky.
Doing a radio show. I can tell you that as well. And we
what
can
are
hear
you
from
doing?
Our listeners.
What's on your mind? 1-877-8-MY-TAKE. MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
The
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
This morning, we're asking you a simple question. What are you doing right now and what's on your mind? Call us 1-877-8-MY-TAKE. Now, some of you may remember we did something very similar last Friday.
Hi, my name is Carolyn Meyer, and I am in Stillwater, Oklahoma, and I'm having coffee in my kitchen with my dog, Beebe, and I'm here at home because I'm retired.
I'm Irma. I'm from New Jersey, and I'm sitting in my bathtub having a bubble bath listening to the radio.
Richard in Hazel Park, Michigan, walking behind a floor scrubber, just doing my janitorial duties. Thanks.
Richard, don't go. We like you so much. Are you there? Good morning. Good morning, Richard. Hello. Now, we're using up your break, so we're going to get to this very quickly. You called us last week, and you had no idea why. What was that experience like?
Well, it was stimulating, informative. I thought that it worked out rather well. I'm sorry, I'm really right in the middle of a pretty bad rush.
Absolutely. What are you doing right now, Richard?
I am desperately trying to scrub out an area in a Home Depot.
Okay, set the scene.
I'm a janitor.
Okay, excellent. So how do you manage to listen to The Takeaway in the morning while you're doing your janitorial duties?
I am I use a portable radio, headphones.
Now, part of our big experiment was to try and find out who out there was listening in our Takeaway community, finding out a little bit more information about where our listeners were, what they were up to. What did you learn as you were listening to? We almost had 400 calls, couldn't even get them all on the air.
I just learned that, like I said this morning, people are just people. They're going about their business. Not everybody is falling apart, and it was heartening, I think, as you listened. Sad for some of the people who have lost their work, you know, but a lot of folks are just, you know, are still able to keep on, and I think that's quite ennobling.
Richard Lavely, he's a listener from Hazel Park in Michigan. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. I know you've got to get back to work, but you'll still be listening to us, so stay tuned.
Well, it's a joy talking to you, Femi.
All right, take care, Richard. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Now, not everybody who took part in our experiment was quite as happy to do it as Richard. Have a listen to some of the callers who were asking us, why were we asking them what they were doing?
Good morning. This is Chris from Brooklyn, and I'm in my car, by the way. But I've been listening since, like, 6 o'clock, and I'm still trying to figure out why this is interesting. Why does everybody have to know where everybody is and what they're doing? I don't get it. Have a great day. Bye. Hi, Chris from Brooklyn again. I still don't get why it's interesting. It doesn't intrigue me to know that at 6 o'clock in the morning, people are in the bathroom and in the kitchen and in their car. Where else would they be? Bye.
Chris from Brooklyn, you have an interesting point. We will put that point to the man responsible for last Friday and this Friday's experiment, Jim Colgan. He's a Takeaway producer out there in Brooklyn. Morning, Jim.
Morning, Femi. How's it going?
Very well. Thank you very much. Nice to see you. Are you in your pajamas, actually?
I am. I'm not going to say.
maybe that might be TMI. Okay.
Yeah.
Explain the experiment. What were we trying to do on the air?
Well, I guess we do owe that listener, Christine, an explanation, even though she was obviously interested. She called more than once. But so I had this kind of strange idea about a social network, just using things like Twitter and Facebook and this other thing called Foursquare, where you literally just check in and you just say what's on your mind. And people ask, even when Twitter started and when Facebook started, like, why would I do that? But look at it. They're, you know, they're enormously successful. So, and they've built a big community. So I thought, what if we tried doing that on the air? And so we didn't bother saying anything about Twitter or Facebook. We just said, why don't you just check in with us and tell us what you're doing? And the same thing, it was the same response. It's like, wait, why would people do that? And what would they say? And look what we did. We got an overwhelming response. We got hundreds of people. But still, you can ask the question, what was the point? So, and Christine has that question still. But I think the point is we were able to check in with people and we were able to hear their stories. And we got things like the janitor there, Richard, was saying, we heard stories from people who were unemployed, who were looking for work. And to me, that was interesting to hear. And I think for other people, they were probably pretty curious about them.
Hey, well, Jim, what do you make of it? I mean, 400 responses, people like Richard who called and told us what they were doing, people like Christine who called and said she didn't like the idea, but she called two or three times from her car to let us know that she was in her car and she didn't like what we were doing. What do you make of just the overwhelming interest that people had in it?
Well, I think Chris is conflicted. I think she is intrigued. She is wondering what it is about it that she wants to know. I think she reflexively wants to say, I don't care about that information about people. But she does. She's listening. I spoke to her yesterday, and she told me that she loved hearing from the listeners. So I think people, it's almost like you're not really aware that it's what you want to know, but people like to check in on people. I personally like, I sometimes do more Facebook stalking than I do writing. And I have friends in Ireland, and I know what they're up to just because I see their Facebook status, you know? So I think the more people get used to that, the more they're like, oh, I kind of like this checking in thing. And especially when they see what comes out of it, which is for us stories about what's going on in their lives. And we had we got a call from a janitor, and he said to me yesterday, he was like, why he called in. He never hears a janitor on public radio, so that's why he wanted to check in. He'd never gotten the chance to check in before.
Jim, you know what time it is, don't you? You produce this show. You know what time we're heading up to.
Yes, yes.
Do you want to introduce the news headlines?
Is it Mark?
It's absolutely Mark.
It is.
Mark, how's it going? Now we have headlines with Mark Garrison.
Okay. I didn't know there was going to be a musical Stevie Wonder intro as well. Thank you, Jim, and thank you for calling and saying that you love us as well. It is 28 minutes after the hour. President Obama will be giving a status report on the economy today after meeting with top advisors. Stabilizing the financial system and sparking lending are on the agenda. Wall Street rallied yesterday after a surprisingly strong profit report from banking giant Wells Fargo. The president is asking Congress for $83 billion to help fund the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs says money's running out.
The efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan only have funding through half the fiscal year.
Add it to the money already spent, that will bring the post-9/11 war spending near $1 trillion. North Dakota residents are bracing for another flood crest on the Red River. Warm weather is melting snow, which will pump up the water level. Also overnight, the tornado in Arkansas killed 3 people, and fire crews in Oklahoma and Texas are trying to put out wildfires. Todd and Femi.
Thank you very much. You're listening to The Takeaway. If you want to take part in our grand experiment, 1-877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
The That was music heard earlier this morning in central L'Aquila, where they've begun burying victims of the devastating earthquake that struck early Monday. The Vatican has granted a dispensation so that a funeral mass for most of the 289 people who were killed could be celebrated today on Good Friday. For more, we turned earlier today to BBC correspondent Helen Fox, who was in the devastated city earlier today. When we spoke earlier, I asked Helen to describe the scene in L'Aquila this morning.
Thousands of people have gathered here at a military barracks just on the outskirts of the city. The funeral mass with full state honours is being held in an open-air plaza here because the local churches in the area are considered to be unsafe following the earthquake. The families of the victims, along with senior political figures, including the Prime Minister and the President, are here, as well as members of the emergency services that have been taking part in the rescue efforts, and more than 100 priests, as well as the second most senior figure from the Vatican, who earlier delivered a message from the Pope.
Helen, we can hear funeral mass being celebrated behind you, singing going on. How far are you from the scene of the mass right now?
Well, I'm just to the side of where the mass is taking place. And let me just describe the scene here. There's a stage where the priests are standing, and there's also a choir which are singing. They can hear the sound there. And then there are rows and rows of wooden coffins. On top of some of those coffins are tiny white caskets, and those have the bodies of some of the 16 children that were killed in the earthquake. And those coffins, the tiny white coffins, have been placed on top of the coffins of their parents. And then seated behind the coffins are around 1,600 relatives of those who died. There are around 200 coffins that have been laid out. And then locals, people from the area, people who have been made homeless by the earthquake, are then watching the service take place.
We talked briefly about a special dispensation in order to hold Mass on today, Good Friday. Is there also one? Funerals are not generally conducted during Holy Week at all in the Catholic Church, as I understand it. Is there a dispensation for that as well? There must be.
Well, what's happened here is that this state funeral is being held on Good Friday, a highly symbolic day, obviously, for many people here. And normally Mass is not held on a Friday by the Catholic Church. And so that's why they've had to get special dispensation to have Mass, to enable people to be able to take communion at this funeral. And so that's why this has happened. They've got the special permission from the Vatican to be able to do this. I have to say that in the Pope's message to the people here, he expressed his solidarity with those that have gone through the traumatic events of the earthquake. And he said that he called on God to dry every single tear.
Now, stepping away from the funeral for a moment, Helen, how is the rescue effort going? What's the latest?
At the moment, the death toll now stands at 289, and there are still around 10 people who are unaccounted for. The rescue effort is continuing, and what officials here have said is that it will carry on until there is no hope of finding any survivors alive. But as the days go by, hope is fading that anyone in the rubble is still alive. The last person to be rescued from a collapsed building was a couple of days ago. And so even though people desperately want to see survivors still being found, that is looking increasingly unlikely. And I can just tell you, just now, we've just experienced yet another aftershock. And there have been more than 1,000 since the earthquake. And it's aftershocks like this which are hampering the rescue effort, because it makes the work of the rescuers so much more dangerous and difficult because of these aftershocks.
Helen, this is Femi Okay here. We're getting news out of Italy today that the government's actually making special efforts to help the people who've been caught in this earthquake. Can you give us an idea of what sort of things are happening? I've heard, for instance, utility bills are going to be suspended for 2 months.
Yes, that's right. Utility bills and other payments are going to be suspended for a few months. Just to imagine the what people's lives are like now, people who escaped from the earthquake with only the clothes they're wearing. They have no details. They don't have any identification. They don't have any access to their bank accounts. And so it's very difficult for these people to actually physically pay their bills. Also, the government is going to be helping, giving financial aid to the people that have been caught up in the earthquake. And that's going to be around €400 a month. I believe that's about $500 a month for people who have been affected by the earthquake. And that, those are some of the measures that the government has mentioned. Also, in the long term, the government is going to be helping the reconstruction of this area. The Prime Minister has said that a town could be reconstructed, could be completely built here from the because so many houses were destroyed here. And I have to tell you that the service. Service here up until this point has been a Catholic service, but now because six of the victims were Muslim, the service has now changed so that an imam is now addressing the audience here.
And Helen, quickly, you said the government is stepping in to help, of course, with €400. What about recriminations for poorly built buildings that collapsed? There must be some of those going on.
Yes, there is anger that it wasn't just the old, the ancient, the very beautiful buildings that were destroyed, but also modern buildings. For example, the hospital here was only finished about 10 years ago, and almost all of it has been destroyed. So there is anger about building regulations, and this is something that real serious questions are being asked about.
That was Helen Fox in an interview conducted earlier this morning, reporting to us from the ground in L'Aquila, Italy, where funeral processions are underway for the victims of Monday's devastating earthquake.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway, and I'm Femi Okay.
I'm Todd Zwillick. T-A-K-E. Never mind.
Where are your pom-poms? You look good in a short skirt.
Yeah.
Nice legs.
My sleeveless shirt. I was going to make everyone spell takeaway to rally some team spirit in here. Lord knows you could use it, Femi.
Go, Todd Zwillick.
Yeah. All right. So you've got it. You've got the team spirit. Well, so you might be asking, why all the team spirit? Well, it's the Super Bowl of college cheerleading. It's kicked off yesterday. It's the NCAA College Cheer and Dance Nationals every year. Big cheerleading competition. Kate Turgovnik has written a new book that gives us a look inside the world that most of us might not know anything about. Her book is called Cheer! Inside the Secret World of College Cheerleaders, and she joins us now. Kate, everybody knows a cheerleader. Everyone went to high school with at least a dozen
Absolutely.
Of them.
Absolutely.
With at least a dozen of them. What's in this book about cheerleaders that we don't already think we know?
Well, I think when you think of cheerleaders, you think of prissy, kind of dainty girls on the sidelines with their pom-poms, like you guys mentioned. But competitive college cheerleading is almost the exact opposite. These are tough, gritty athletes who are in a sport where there's constant injuries, and they're in competitions that are won by 0.02, 0.03 at nationals today. I'm sure we'll see it come down to that. And there's a real sort of thrill-seeker vibe. When you talk to college cheerleaders about what they do, they say, I live for competing. Cheerleading is like a drug. I'm addicted to cheerleading. And they sort of talk about it like they're talking about jumping out of airplanes or a motocross biker. It's almost an extreme sport at this point.
Okay, but a lot of all elite collegiate athletes are competitive, hyper-competitive. And when you watch collegiate competitive cheerleading, there's no question that they are elite athletes, tumblers, acrobats, no question. But how are they different at all from other collegiate athletes? I don't see them necessarily different from hyper-competitive basketball players or swimmers or any other athletes like that.
Well, cheerleading is technically not a sport. It's considered an activity. So there's like a real sort of breakdown. It's almost like a split personality between what people think cheerleading is and what cheerleading actually is. And because of that, it's sort of developed into this extreme subculture where it's almost this world with these different rules that I think you don't see in other college sports.
All right. Did you learn anything aside from the subculture of cheerleading? Did you learn anything about the way cheerleading fits into our society? You mentioned in the introduction, why are we so interested in them? Why are we so interested in them? Is it because we all knew cheerleaders when we were young? What's their place in our society?
Yeah, I think they fit into this sort of high school taxonomy, and high school movies still talk to people very, very, very strongly, and television shows. And I think in some ways, as women, they sort of straddle that fault line between virgin and whore in this really interesting way when you look at them in pop culture.
All right. Now, I have to ask about you, because
yes.
In your book, you describe yourself as the girl who was smoking cigarettes across the park while the rest of the school was in the pep rally with the cheerleaders, worshiping the cheerleaders. So why the heck did you choose the cheerleaders as a subject to spend probably a year of your life on?
Oh, yeah. I followed these teams for a year and then spent a year writing the book. So basically what happened is I went to College Cheerleading Nationals, what's happening today, and started talking to cheerleaders and was hearing these sort of descriptions of injuries. Like, I got 2 concussions and I broke my arm and I've broken a few ribs and I knocked my jaw out of place, and was just really noticing that it was very different than what I expected. And I just really got pulled in by sort of the passion and sort of extremeness of these people.
Didn't think they had it in them, did you?
Yeah, I totally didn't. And now I do.
All right. Kate Turgovnik is the author of Cheer, Inside the Secret World of College Cheerleaders. She spent a year inside their secret world. You can read her book and learn a little bit about what makes a cheerleader tick. Kate, thanks.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Well, she's almost right. It's Femi OK and Todd Zwillick this morning. Todd, you are about to talk to Smoking Joe Frazier. Can't wait for that, but you'll have to because Mark Garrison has some of the news headlines for you. First of all, Mark.
Thank you. 12 minutes before the hour, 5 American soldiers are dead and another injured after a truck bombing in the northern Iraqi city of Mosul. Iraqi police died as well. The suicide bomber slammed into a police station with a truck full of explosives. The president is asking Congress for $83 billion to help fund the wars there in Iraq and also Afghanistan. Added to money already spent since 9/11, that would bring the spending to nearly $1 trillion. The American merchant captain held by Somali pirates tried to make a break for it. He jumped out of the lifeboat and swam, but a nearby Navy ship wasn't close enough to rescue him. Pirates got to him first. American negotiators are talking with the pirates. Todd and Femi.
You've got a feeling that Hollywood producers are talking about the movie rights already for that scenario. Okay, thanks very much, Mark. Todd.
Femi, it is time for Smokin' Joe Frazier, former heavyweight boxing champion. He's the central figure in a documentary called Thrilla in Manila, and that's going to air on HBO.
Excellent.
Tomorrow night. The film is a look back at one of the most brutal rivalries in the history of sports. That's between Frazier and Muhammad Ali.
The Rumble in the Jungle.
The Rumble in the Jungle. It was in Kinshasa. That's George Foreman. You're about to learn that this is the Thriller in Manila.
Yes,
these are 3 different fights. You're talking about Foreman, but we'll probably touch on that as well.
Excellent.
Because
okay,
I think
ahead.
We're talking about 3 fights that took place between 1971
yes.
and 1975, culminating in the Thriller in Manila. The film is told, though, from Frazier's point of view.
Right.
And it's the first time we've gotten his perspective. We've gotten Ali's perspective in a lot of films and a lot of books. But it also doesn't paint a very flattering picture of one of America's idols, Muhammad Ali. Listen to this.
Now you're fighting a spiritual holy war when you face me now.
But when you're fighting Joe Frazier, is that a spiritual
holy war? Yes, sir.
Why?
Because he's the Uncle Tom.
Oh, he's not an Uncle Tom.
He's not. Why did he insist on calling me Cassius Clay when even the worst of the white enemies recognize Muhammad Ali? He's the other type Negro. He's not like me. There are two type slaves. Joe Frazier's worse than you to me. That's what I mean when I say Uncle Tom. See, he's a brother. One day he might be like me. But as of now, he works for the enemy.
Smokin' Joe Frazier himself joins us now from Philadelphia. And in London, we're joined by John Dower, the director of the documentary that appears on HBO tomorrow night. Mr. Frazier, can I call you Joe?
Yeah, call me Smokin' Joe.
Can I call you Smokin' Joe? It's my honor.
Why not?
It's my honor.
How you been?
I've been very well. Thank you. Thank you, champ. Smokin' Joe, you say in the film that Ali is now being paid back for what he said and what he did in those days, and that God wrote it down and is paying him back. Do you really believe that?
Sure.
Why?
Sure, well, because number one, he runs around and said, I am thee. Now, you see, you can be thee, but there ain't but one thee, the Lord above. You understand? We can be the, but we can't be thee. Very seldom we use that name in a sentence. Let's say when you're speaking about thee, it's the. So therefore, he jumps around saying, I am the greatest. I am this. And the Lord marks it down. You and I don't pay attention, which I do, but most people don't take it, what he's saying.
Well, the film is really the first time, Smokin' Joe, that we've gotten your perspective on this rivalry with Muhammad Ali, and you've been waiting to tell your story. But if there's one thing that Ali was good at, in addition to his jab, it was telling his story. So why'd you wait so long to tell yours?
I was busy fighting, you know what I mean? I was busy fighting and raising my kids, you know what I mean, and getting in shape and doing what I have to do to get the job done, you know what I mean? And that's why it took me this long. But therefore, he talks and talks and talks, you know. And my daddy tell me, said, the wagon go down the road empty, guess what? That's it. Ain't nothing in it. So therefore,
well,
an empty wagon.
Maybe not nothing. He was, like you, he was heavyweight champion of the world. I guess he gets to talk a little bit, but maybe not as much as he did. John in London, can I turn to you? I'd like you, if you would, to bring us briefly back to 1975 and remind us what the Ali Frazier fight in the Philippines, the thrill in Manila, was all about. Just how big a deal to the world it was at the time. Can you describe that?
Well, it's interesting, actually. Good morning, by the way. Good morning, America, from London. It's interesting that your co-presenter, and a lot of people make this, you know, misconception, immediately said Rumble in the Jungle.
Yeah.
I know. I'm sorry.
No. Don't worry.
I was about five at
the time. That's fine. I'm not
going
to get on at you for that. That's fine. Yeah. A lot of other people do it. You're not alone. But the problem is because of the whole Muhammad Ali mythology, the kind of great fights stop there. You know, the Michael Mann film about Ali stopped at the Rumble in the Jungle. And, of course, you know, we have When We Were Kings, which is about that fight.
Yep.
So people kind of, that final fight in Manila is glossed over. And one of the reasons, as we show in our film, is because, you know, Ali technically won it, but it was a close-run thing. And I think it is one of the most extraordinary fights of all time, possibly the most extraordinary sporting contest of all time. And we thought, you know, somebody needs to make a film about this, so we're going to do it.
Yeah, well, one of the things that's so interesting about the Ali Frazier rivalry is the way that it reflected on the cultural conflicts at the time, and Ali certainly was a master at capitalizing on them in the 1970s. Let's listen to a clip that captures what Ali was all about at the time.
They told me I was going to fight in Manila, so I wrote a poem. It'll be a thriller and a killer and a chiller when I get that gorilla in Manila.
And then he whipped out a little rubber gorilla, which was, he said, the soul of Joe Frazier.
John, you spent a lot of time in this film really calling Ali to task for what you say is racism and also a betrayal of his friend, Joe Frazier. Can you explain why you went so hard at Ali?
Well, I mean, let me be clear. I don't want people to get the impression that we set out to make a film that trashes Muhammad Ali. You know, we didn't. We unashamedly set out to make a film that told the story from Joe Frazier's point of view. But in the process of doing that, I think we showed a side to Muhammad Ali that has kind of been forgotten and swept under the carpet. I mean, Ali has been turned into this kind of woolly saint. And, you know, part of the reason for that is, you know, if we're going to be blunt about it, is because he's now ill and he's become kind of benign. And I think what this film does remind people is that in his treatment of Joe Frazier, which, you know, I personally, and I'm sure others, find, you know, abhorrent, really, that he was a more complicated and complex character.
Champ, Smokin' Joe was... I watched the film and saw how badly Ali did treat you in public, but he got under your skin and he got you to fight back with words and seemed to get you concerned. He'd show up at your practice and get under your skin. Isn't it possible that he was just trying to psych you out and he was such a big personality that he was trying to psych you out in front of the whole world?
I guess that's his way of handling himself, let's say, along with his opponent. And that's what we were at that time. But therefore, I didn't pay any attention to it, you know what I mean? I went on and did my job. I did my job the way it was supposed to be done. And I got myself in the best of shape that I can go. So I really don't really pay too attention to that, what he's saying, you know what I mean? My daddy tell me an empty wag. A wag can go down the road, make a lot of noise, got to be empty. So therefore, these things that he was put together on this like time when he could put his poem together and rhyme it and talk. So therefore, I really didn't pay that much attention to what was going on.
You didn't pay that much attention. It seemed like with you leading up to the fight in 75 that it was almost the same setup as with Foreman in Kinshasa in 74. It was like a wrestling match. You had the face and the heel. Ali was the face. He was the, quote, good guy in front of the world, and Foreman was the heel, and he kind of tried to make you the heel as well.
Yeah, but, you know, we look at it the same way that everybody else does, you know what I mean? Go and get the job done and pay no attention to it. And, like, you know, he said he was handsome than most anybody else in the whole wide world. And I see a lot of fine guys, you know. I've seen ugly guys do a little better than he does, you know what I mean?
Okay, unfortunately, we have to leave it there. But I'm encouraging everyone to watch this film tomorrow night. My guests were the legendary Smokin' Joe Frazier, who fought Muhammad Ali and is the subject of the film Thrilla in Manila by director John Dower, who joined us from London.
Todd, you're so lucky to speak to Joe Frazier. What a great voice there. So, as you've been hearing this morning, we are doing an experiment. All you have to do is tell us your name, where you are, what you're doing, what's on your mind.
Hi, this is Carolyn in Lincoln, Rhode Island. I'm in the baby's bedroom and I'm about to change a diaper.
Hello, my name is Joseph Custodio. I'm calling just east of the George Washington Bridge. I just left my Upper West Side apartment, and I'm driving to work in New Jersey.
This is Doug. I'm from Mansfield, getting ready to ride my bike to work, about 28 miles, and I'm thinking I wish I had some company out there.
Hi, good morning. My name is Helga. I live on Long Island. And I am in my kitchen right now feeding my 10 cats.
We can't help it. We're really, really nosy. Tell us, what are you doing? You can give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. If you missed any of the show today, you can get it at thetakeaway.org. And we're just about to sign off now. I'm Femi OK.
I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Call me Smokin' Joe.
I stand before you and the world, humbled by this recognition and uplifted by the honor of being the 2004 Nobel Peace Laureate.
Let the trumpet sound. We have a Nobel laureate in the house. Dr. Wangari Maathai, the environmentalist, activist, and the tree lover you can't stop yourself from hugging, is standing by for your questions. Are you ready, Dr. Maathai?
I'm ready.
We will see. Ask a Nobel laureate anything you want, only on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, April the 10th. I'm Femi Okeh. John Hockenberry is off today and Adora Udoji is home with her baby. So our friend Todd Zwillick is with us instead.
Well, coming up this hour, using Baltimore as the model for stimulus spending, why the Obama administration is changing its policy on photographing dead soldiers and the environmental revolution in Africa. All this coming up, but first, these headlines.
The U.S. military says that five soldiers died in a suicide truck bombing outside an Iraqi army and police base early this morning. The bomber rammed a security barrier into the northern Iraqi city of Mosul. At least seven people are dead and 70 injured. President Obama is asking Congress for an additional $83 billion in supplemental funding for the military. In that request, he asked for $400 million to ramp up security along the U.S.-Mexico border. The president had promised to end the practice of funding the military with special funding instead of listing all military spending in the annual budget. The president meets with senior economic advisers at the White House this morning to talk about rising unemployment and stress tests put to the nation's 19 biggest banks. But the federal government told those banks not to talk about the results of those stress tests yet. And the president meets with Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner, Fed Chief Ben Bernanke and FDIC Chair Sheila Blair and others.
Mi sento spiritualmente presente.
That's Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone reading a message from the Pope to the 10,000 people gathered in L'Aquila to mourn the victims of Monday's earthquake. In his message, Pope Benedict said that he shared the anguish of those people and hoped they would find the courage to overcome their grief. And the ship captain held by Somali pirates is still being held hostage, but there are reports that the captain tried to swim away last night but was recaptured. The pirate's lifeboat is drifting in the Indian Ocean where it's run out of fuel.
Now, the Dow closed yesterday at 8083 and the S&P ended at 1652. Markets are closed today. And this hour, it's Casual Friday today on The Takeaway. We have no formal question. You can wear your jeans. Send us your comments about any of the stories we're covering. You won't be disappointed. We have a Nobel Peace Laureate, Wangari Maathai, on. She's a Kenyan environmentalist activist. We're also talking about the stimulus plan, maybe where you live, and specifically in Baltimore, and also talking about the U.S. Masters in Augusta, Georgia. Casual Friday on The Takeaway. 1-877-8-MY-TAKE. And you can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org, even if you're wearing your jeans.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, it's Femi Okeh and Todd Zwillick sitting in this morning. Vice President Joe Biden announced yesterday that the federal government is releasing $2.3 billion in Recovery Act funding for childcare and vaccines. The announcement is the latest in a flurry of national and local announcements on how stimulus spending will be spent. But many communities are wondering whether stimulus funding will actually bring jobs to their neighborhoods. Joining us to talk about this is Takeaway correspondent Andrea Bernstein, who is watching the stimulus spending in our Shovel Watch project. Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning.
And we also have Mark Steiner. He's a producer and host at WEAA in Baltimore. And Mark Steiner is also the host of The Mark Steiner Show. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. Pleasure to be with you all.
We'll get to you in just a moment. But Andrew, just set us out nationally. What stimulus spending has been distributed so far?
Well, actually, quite a bit. And most of the money that's come out so far into people's pockets has come out in the form of individual benefits. So most American workers now are seeing a tax cut, and they're actually seeing a little bit of increased money in their paycheck. Food stamp grants have been increased. People who have lost their jobs and are using COBRA insurance are being able to apply for an extension. And also unemployment benefits are being extended. The sort of big thing that's happened is money has gone to the states for these so-called fiscal stabilization funds. And what that means is that the states, many states who are facing these drastic budget crunches, have been able to cut their budgets less than they wanted to. So the idea is they have to lay off fewer workers, they can continue to put money in the economy in various ways. And then the other big pocket of money is that the transportation and infrastructure funds are beginning to arrive in the states and to be allocated for specific projects.
So when a specific project's beginning to start, do we have a date? Is there a timeline?
Well, this is the thing about the stimulus funding is all, even though it is President Obama's program, the priorities are each being said in each of the 50 states. So there is a different story everywhere. And some of the states made up their minds very, very quickly. Maryland is one of them. New Jersey is another. Massachusetts. These are all states where they have a sort of streamlined planning process. They said right away, we know where we want our money to go, and they've begun to bid out the projects. Other states, particularly some big ones like New York, California, they're still deciding. They're very much in the process. They're gathering information and are much, much slower. But in Maryland, for example, right now, Highway 650 is getting resurfaced. In North Carolina, US 158 is getting widened. So some of these projects are actually beginning to be built around the country.
Let me bring in Mark Steiner, who's in Baltimore, WEAA. Andrea, you said yesterday that Baltimore was a classic example of a good model for stimulus spending.
Well, one of the things that's very interesting about Maryland is that Maryland is not only extremely organized, there's a lot of transparency in the states, but a lot of people around the country who are beginning the conversation sort of, okay, now the stimulus money is coming, so who is actually going to get these jobs, say that Baltimore is an example where there's a high level of community involvement in the planning and in this discussion about making sure the jobs go all through the community and not just to a specific sector. And that's a big concern that a lot of people are articulating across the country that we're hearing now is people are saying, I know that road building is coming, but I'm not an asphalt layer. I'm not trained in this. So how is it going to benefit me?
Mark, Andrew was just talking about community, and you've been holding community town halls. What was the sort of response you were getting back from people talking about the stimulus?
Well, I think people are really digging under this kind of surface conversation that some people in the media, not you all, but some people are having about the stimulus package. And we can talk about money coming in, and the people in the town meeting were talking about, look, let's build a different model in Baltimore where local people are really trained to do lead and weatherization, get their certification so they can change how they do contracts in Baltimore so that people can actually get contracts from the city and create a system that is long-term sustainable for people and not just going to huge companies from outside of Baltimore and outside the state where local people are hired for the dirtiest work and then don't keep working. So there's a real conversation going on here in Baltimore about how do you use this money to really stimulate a local economy as opposed to just giving people temporary jobs that are over in a year. I mean, I think that's the critical difference in the conversations taking place here.
I want to bring in a part of the conversation you had at the town hall, but first of all, I need you to set the scene for us, Mark. Tell us how much money Baltimore has roughly got to spend out of the stimulus package.
It has exactly at the moment a very strange number, $368,818,114.
And you don't have it down to the penny?
Okay, so now we know the sum Baltimore's got to play with. I want you to listen to Jamie Kendrick. He's the co-chair of the Baltimore Economic Recovery Team, and he details how that money is going to be spent.
In that $250 million in formula is about $4 million for Head Start, $3.6 for Youth Works, summer jobs type programs, $54 million over 2 years for Title I education, $26.5 million for special education, about $5.5 million for job training programs through the Office of Employment Development, $33.5 million or so for roads and bridges in the city directly spent by the city, another plus or minus
Okay.
35
you can
for
stop
transit
now. Help.
That'll be spent by the
Let
MTA.
Me out. Mark, in the town hall, you waited. You waited for Jamie to finish, and you had to actually pull him up short in the end. So this,
I did.
This money is pretty much parceled out. What do people in Baltimore, where do they want that money to actually go? How do they want it to be spent?
Well, other than how I described before in terms of changing how people are actually trained so they can have long-term work, one of the problems is that when they did this bill, because they were trying to keep money out of the hands of the wealthy, that you can't do things like swimming pools and rec centers, which are critical to urban centers like Baltimore and the deindustrialized cities. Because that means that, let's say, that people can't, you can't hire a lifeguard to work a swimming pool for young people.
Now
you can't refurbish a pool.
Explain this. There's a little bit more background to this. Why can't you refurbish your local swimming pool?
Because there's no money in there for recreation and parks, because they said no money for golf courses, swimming pools, anything like that, without thinking about what the needs are for a city. So the city's going to have to think about how to use that money in a more creative way. In other words, using weatherization money and energy money to redo a pool or to fix the roofs on recreation centers that put people to work and then maybe have money left over so we can hire lifeguards to keep inner city kids in the summer with a place to swim. I mean, so there's kind of strange contradictions in this. And the city here, with the help of the community, is trying to kind of think more creatively about how to get around those restrictions.
Well, hey, Mark, it's Todd Zwillick. Is Baltimore the only city you know of that's bringing in the community in this way to actually do interaction between the senior elder fathers and mothers of the city and the community to figure out where they're going to create jobs?
No, I think it's going on in other cities. And I think what's happening, at least what happened in Baltimore, is that you had kind of a blue-collar mayor that hired some interesting people in her administration that allowed that conversation to take place. But you also had a kind of a grassroots swell, people demanding, like they did this town meeting that I ran and the others were going to have these kind of conversations that very rarely take place. The proof will be in the pudding.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, there is a national effort. There's a group called Policy Link, which is based in the East Bay in California, which is trying to sort of ask these questions and get communities involved. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that different areas are doing are trying to sort of figure out ways to get some of the things that you're talking about. So, for example, in the surface transportation bill, which both the president and the vice president have sort of miscalled the highway bill, there's money for bike paths, there's money for pedestrian things. Or you have a city like New York City, which is taking some money from the stimulus package, putting it into something it was already going to build, and then using that money, for example, to plant trees in Bedford-Stuyvesant to improve the business district. So there is some creativity happening in these cities now.
Mark, let me share with our listeners a young lady called Magda Phillips. She goes to a high school in Baltimore. Listen to her plea.
We are waiting for money so that we can help build new organizations so that we can help the young people. And there's a lot of programs now, but there are some who can't pay their young people because there's just no money. And we've done so much to try to convince the city government. There's been hunger strikes with me and my other friends who we starved for 4.5 days and the mayor still didn't give us any money. And we've slept out on City Hall and we still didn't get any money.
Mark, how do people get money out of their stimulus package?
Well, this particular group, too, you talked about was called Peer-to-Peer, which is this coalition of young people from public schools all across the city that are activists, and they have organized themselves with some other adult organizations to ask for $3 million to be given to Peer-to-Peer to work youth programs with other youth, mentoring, tutoring.
Mark, I just have to ask you for just a quick one-liner, yeah, because we're wrapping up, and I want people to know, how do they get the stimulus money? How do they get to use it?
They're going to have to fight for it. They're going to have to negotiate with the city to bring the money into those community groups, and that process is just beginning.
Mark Steiner is a host and producer of The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA Radio in Baltimore, and The Takeaway's political director, Andrea Bernstein, watches the stimulus spending with our Shovel Watch project. Thanks to you both.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
The Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hi, good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick. Last weekend, the remains of Staff Sergeant Philip Myers were returned to Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. The ceremony surrounding his flag-draped casket was open to reporters for the first time in 18 years. In February, the Pentagon decided to lift its ban on media coverage of the war dead if the family approves of that coverage. Pictures of casualties have just started appearing on our televisions and in our newspapers following that decision. Vietnam, of course, was called the Living Room War, much for the extensive television coverage just of this sort of flag-draped coffins. Well, we want to know, how does a visual image change how you view warfare? Do you think that seeing caskets makes the war more palatable or less? Tell us what you think at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Well, now, for a look at what the overturning of the ban could mean, we're joined by Kathleen Hall Jamison. She's director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania, and she's co-author of Presidents Creating the Presidency. Professor Jamison, why do you think President Obama and now the Pentagon have changed the policy on coverage of the war dead at Dover now? Is it just to fulfill a campaign promise?
There's been an ongoing controversy about this since the policy was put in place. And as a result, a new president is faced with the question, are you going to continue the policy or are you going to rescind it? Consistent with what he said in the campaign, he rescinded it. And I think in a very dexterous way, the issue as framed had been privacy of the families versus coverage of something that affects the nation, that is the cost of war. And in the compromise, the families make the decision about whether they would like that moment of their lives and of the lives of their lost family member covered by the media or not. And I think it's a good compromise because it essentially resolves the dilemma. You can't say that the privacy of the families has been intruded upon when they've given consent.
Now the president, the commander-in-chief, of course, gets to remind the country of the cost of war and human lives by doing this and makes a move towards a full disclosure of the cost of war. But he also runs a risk, doesn't he? Any commander-in-chief, when they're fighting a war, they own that war. And if the number of those flag-draped coffins start to pile up and pile up on the television screens, he runs a risk there, doesn't he?
It's a risk that a president ought to take because that is an actual cost. And it's important for the community to be reminded of the cost, set aside the political implications, because it is, after all, a cost that the country is paying family by family. We tend to focus on the financial cost of war when this policy is in place, but to downplay the human cost of war. And reminding the country and reminding ourselves as individuals within the country of that cost becomes a way of ensuring that we're talking about the war, asking why we're there, whether we're accomplishing our objectives, and assessing whether or not these sacrifices are actually being made in service of goals worthy of the lives that are being spent.
Well, I just want to point out, as far as Iraq is concerned, Iraq, of course, hasn't been in the headlines very much lately. February 2009, the U.S. lost 17 soldiers in Iraq, 9 in March, 3 so far this month of April. We're losing about one soldier every other day in Iraq. Professor, you've said that it's the president who's brought Iraq back into the headlines, that the media wasn't covering it well. He lifted the ban on photographs of the flag-draped coffins and then his surprise visit to Iraq on the way back from the European swing at the end of the week. I noticed all of this comes just before yesterday. He's asked for another $83 billion to fight the war. Was the president very deftly reminding the public that there's a war going on so that he can ask for it to be funded?
It's always dangerous to try to figure out what's inside someone's head when they make a decision. I think that one of the consequences of the decision is that the country is more likely to have that piece of evidence in mind as it looks at that request for funding. But there's another context for this. The country, through the 50s and 1960s, used to, on Memorial Day and 4th of July, even in small communities, mid-sized communities, and large communities around the country, memorialize and honor those who died in war. And that became a moment for the country to consider the costs, consequences, and also to pay tribute to the people who had fallen in war. We have given up much of that of that important ceremonial moment. And as a result, those moments in which honor is given and those moments of reminder. In that context, if we're going to stay focused on costs of war, not having access to the visuals means that there really aren't moments in which the country is regularly reminded unless journalism is on the ground covering the war the way it did in Vietnam. That's not happening now for a number of reasons.
Well, journalism is not on the war with as many embeds covering the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. It seems like the media's lost a lot of interest in Iraq because the casualty counts aren't as high and things are starting to improve. Do you agree with that, that the media's dropped the ball? Does having coverage at Dover help refocus us in any way that has a lasting effect?
Depends on how much coverage there is on an ongoing basis. I suspect that at the community level, there is going to be some coverage carried forward from these individual moments in which the families consent. But the fact that these visuals are now available also means that they can be interpolated into the stories about Iraq and Afghanistan when those stories are offered. So instead of those stories simply being stories about the politics involved, there is now an increased likelihood that there will be that reminder because the visuals are available to remind, and that's potentially important.
Is there a risk of diminishing returns with these images, that people, at first, they're very salient and people become numb to them, and then you're, in terms of the public's reaction to the cost of war, that you're right back where you started in a few months?
There have been two very effective journalistic efforts to ensure that that wouldn't happen. The News Hour with Jim Lehrer on PBS, and this week, that was George Stephanopoulos on ABC, have been memorializing the individuals who've died.
They're honor roll. Yes, they're honor roll.
And that honor roll becomes, particularly in those outlets, which have they have high attention among the news viewing public, become a reminder on a very regular basis of the cost. And so because that journalistic convention has emerged, we have not lost track of the cost. At least we have not, those who pay attention to those two media outlets. The question now becomes, will the media, as they cover the politics of the stories of Iraq and Afghanistan, and as they cover the various moves that are made both here and in those countries to accomplish objectives set by either, will they now find journalistic conventions to add these visuals to those narratives with the numbers that signal the total cost?
Kathleen Hall Jamieson is director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor, thank you for joining us and helping us understand all that. Mark Garrison is here to help us understand all of the day's headlines.
Thanks, Todd. I'll do my best. 29 minutes after the hour, the CIA is closing secret overseas prisons used to detain terror suspects. The so-called black sites were places where some of the most controversial interrogation techniques, such as waterboarding, were used. President Obama will give an update on the economy after meeting with top advisors today. He'll talk stabilizing the financial system overall and jumpstarting bank lending in general. In other financial news, Wall Street and European markets are closed today for Good Friday, but Asian markets rose a bit in light trading today. And in sports, baseball fans are mourning the loss of a promising young pitcher. Los Angeles Angels rookie Nick Adenhart died in a car accident mere hours after pitching a great game. Police say the driver of the car that hit him had a blood alcohol level over the legal limit. Todd and Femi.
Mark,
thank you very much.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Oslo, December the 10th, 2004, the trumpet sounded as Dr. Wangari Maathai made her way in to the Nobel Prize ceremony wearing bright, outrageous orange. Good morning, Dr. Maathai.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Femi.
Can you remember that exact moment with those trumpets blowing there?
It was just extraordinary, overwhelming.
What are you doing here this morning, by the way?
Well, I'm here to talk about a new book that we have just published, called The Challenge for Africa, published by Pantheon.
Okay, we keep our audience wanting and waiting for more. We have a Nobel laureate, the environmentalist, the activist, and the tree lover, Wangari Maathai. She's here with us in the Takeaway studio today. Todd.
In the meantime, Femi, the U.S. Navy is on its way to communicate with Somali pirates, holding an American merchant captain hostage. So far, he hasn't been harmed. His shipping company, Maersk, says he has radio, and he's been provided with additional batteries and provisions. The BBC's Mary Harper is on the line, and Wangari Maathai is still with us, of course. Mary, are you there?
Yes, lots of ships are moving around the high seas. You have at least two American warships coming as fast as they can towards this lifeboat where the captain is being held to join another American warship that's already there. And then the actual vessel that was temporarily hijacked is now on its way to Kenya. And then perhaps most extraordinary of all, I've been speaking to the BBC reporter in Somalia, who tells me that he's been speaking to some pirates who say that they are now sending one of the ships that they took captive earlier towards the lifeboat with some of the hostages on board in order to serve as kind of human shields.
As human shields, not as bargaining chips, but as human shields?
I think it's a bit of both, because obviously if the other hostages are taken to the scene, that will enhance the pirate's bargaining power. But the pirate describes them as human shields, I think partly to protect the pirates that are in the lifeboat with the captain of the Alabama.
Is there any way to know at this point what accounts for just the sheer brazenness of these pirates? I mean, facing down one warship is usually enough for most criminals. Now they're facing three and upping the ante. Is there anything to account for this?
Well, I think Somalis, really, in general, they never seem to be afraid of anything. If you think that they saw off the American troops in the 1990s, they're not afraid of the world's greatest power. They almost seem to become more brazen the greater the threat that they face. So, comments that have been coming unconfirmed from the pirates are saying that they're prepared to fight and they'll carry on fighting till the last.
Let me just bring in Dr. Wangari Maathai into our conversation. She's the Nobel Peace Prize winning activist and environmentalist. Dr. Maathai, you're Kenyan. You know East Africa very well. What aspect of this story are we not covering because we're covering it from a Western perspective?
Well, I think that one of the issues that we need to be concerned about is the fact that for more than 18 years now, this country has been a failed state. And it has almost been left to itself. And I know that the African Union has been trying very hard to get troops to bring this country back to law and order. And it has been very difficult. And perhaps this crisis of the pirates exemplifies the fact that this should not just be a problem of Somalia on her own or Africa on her own. It's really a global problem, and it's very important. It is in the interest of all of us not to have these failed states.
Mary, you've talked to pirates directly in the past on your cell phone, haven't you?
Yes, and in fact, I was just going to say that the pirate that I spoke to at the end of last year echoes Wangari Maathai's comments exactly. I've actually got a quote of what he said, and he said, "There's been no peace in Somalia for 18 years. There's no life here. We have no choice. And until the problem of government is solved, there's nothing that can be done." So the pirates themselves understand that the reason why they're going about these escapades is because they come from a country that has completely fallen apart, and they'll do anything in order to survive.
Are you suggesting that in addition to, obviously they're after money because they hold ransom, they kidnap people and hold ransom, that in addition to that they actually have a political agenda, or is that going too far?
I think that might be pushing it a little bit. Okay. Even though the reason why the pirates are there, the reason why they're so active is because of a failed political system, it doesn't mean that they themselves have got a political agenda. I think they are doing it almost purely for the money.
Almost purely for the money. Well, three warships soon to be on hand. A lot of people in the States might be wondering why a crack SEAL team hasn't swum underneath that lifeboat and snatched the captain away by this point. Is there any that might be something out of the movies, but a lot of people are starting to ask that question.
Yes, I can understand that. And in fact, the whole this whole scenario of the piracy off the Somali coast is like a movie, the way in which they capture these enormous tankers, the way just a handful of pirates manage to throw ropes up, climb up onto these ships and take them captive. The whole thing is like it's out of the movies. And I think the ending of this crisis is very likely. None of us know how it's going to end, but it's very possible that it might end just like we're watching it in the movies. It's almost a surreal situation.
That was Mary Harper, the BBC's Africa editor, coming to us from London, sharing some of her experiences with pirates directly. Mary's going to write a blog post for our website on how she talked to that pirate. Go to thetakeaway.org for more.
And we have a Nobel laureate in the house, Dr. Wangari Maathai, the Nobel Peace Prize-winning activist and author of The Challenge for Africa, is staying with us. But right now, it's time to catch up with your latest news headlines with Mark Garrison.
Thank you. I'll give you some new information since the conversation we just had about the pirate situation. The American merchant captain held by Somali pirates actually tried to make a break for it. He jumped out of the lifeboat and swam, but a nearby Navy ship was not quite close enough to rescue him. Pirates got there first. As we know, there's a U.S. Navy warship on the scene. The destroyer captain has been talking with pirates. He's getting advice from FBI hostage negotiators. Jack Clunan is a former negotiator for the FBI.
You're not necessarily so concerned about the pirates because you'll get them when they decide eventually to give up. What you're concerned about is that captain.
Pirates apparently fear being shot or arrested if they hand over the American hostage. Five American soldiers are dead and another injured after a truck bombing in the northern Iraqi city of Mosul today. Iraqi police died as well. The suicide bomber slammed into a police station with a truck full of explosives. The U.S. military says two suspects have been detained. Al-Qaeda-style suicide attacks have plagued Iraq's third largest city of Mosul lately. President Obama is asking Congress for $83 billion to help fund the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The White House says the money is in danger of running out soon. The president has promised to remove all combat troops from Iraq by the end of 2011. Earlier today, Pope Benedict granted special permission for the funeral mass for earthquake victims. This is very unusual, as the Catholic Church normally does not celebrate mass on Good Friday. It was an outdoor mass. None of the churches in the region are safe enough to enter. The Pope, via a proxy who was speaking for him at the mass in the region, urged mourners not to give up hope. Pope Benedict plans to tour the area personally after Easter Sunday. Todd and Femi.
Thanks, Mark. And was that about a tornado in Arkansas?
There was. I believe it was three were dead there. Also wildfires in Oklahoma and Texas.
Excellent. Thanks for the update.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm Femi Okay. The Masters Tournament is in Augusta, Georgia. It started yesterday with a great start by Chad Campbell, who threatened the record books. Campbell ended the day with a 7 under par 65. Joining us now is our sports blogger, Ibrahim Abdul-Martin, although I like to call him my sports brain. Ibrahim is here to tell us more about what's been happening on the greens in Georgia. Can you tell us a little bit more about this Chad Campbell? Did a pretty good job yesterday.
Chad almost broke the record. You know, you have to know that the Masters is the golf course that's one of the most difficult golf courses to play in the entire world. So he almost broke a record, but he just missed it.
Does he have any shot of winning the entire tournament, getting that green jacket?
We have to remember that golf is 4 days. This is 4 rounds. Anything can happen. Anything can change. And Chad always has to remember that Phil Mickelson, Greg Norman, and of course, the dreaded Tiger Woods is always clicking at his heels.
Okay, let's have a listen in to what Tiger Woods had to say about coming to the Masters in Augusta.
I was surprised how fast I got the feeling it came back to me at the match play. That, you know, like Stevie says, and you know, it feels like we haven't left. You know, it feels the same. I said, yeah, it feels good, doesn't it?
What do you think of Tiger's performance at the moment?
Well, yesterday he misjudged the wind a little bit. He birdied at 9. He played exceptionally well off the tee. But I think the key thing is that he swung really well, and Tiger looks stronger than ever.
Do you think we'd actually care? I used to live in Georgia, so I know all about the Masters. Yeah, right. I know it's on. Okay, so do you think people would care if Tiger Woods wasn't actually playing? Would they care as much?
I was just thinking about this yesterday. Is Tiger like Pele to soccer? Is Tiger like Muhammad Ali to boxing? I think Tiger and golf go hand in hand, and it goes connected completely with the Masters. You don't really have golf right now without Tiger Woods.
Right. So what else should we be keeping an eye on? As you said, it's 4 days, not just one day. 4 days.
Well, there's a slew of old talent, a bunch of older guys over 50. The golf ball doesn't know age.
Did you say old guys?
Yeah.
Great.
And then there's a whole slew of people that Tiger opened up the door for, a bunch of younger, more diverse, really talented, strong players that are on the field. So it's old versus new, and the Masters is the playground.
What about Phil Mickelson? Does he come as an old guy or a new guy?
Phil Mickelson is Tiger's nemesis. Between Phil and Tiger, they've combined to win 5 of the last 6 Masters. So Phil's definitely in the hunt.
Oh, you know him. You like Phil. Let's have a listen into him.
It's just not something that I think about. You know, we're all trying to do our best and have our own careers and succeed. And in golf, it is not like tennis where you have constant head-to-head matches. You're always playing against the course and playing stroke play, except for the 1 week of the year at the match play.
And a quick prediction for the weekend, although I know you don't like to do predictions, but give us one anyway.
Well, Greg Norman is the fan favorite, so we're looking to see if Greg Norman, the old guy, can make some history and make some drama out of it. Definitely Tiger's going to come back, and he's going to get some birdies and some eagles. He's going to make it exciting.
He's Ibrahim Abdul-Martin. He's our sports expert. Thank you very much, Ibrahim. You're very lucky that we didn't actually call in Dr. Wangarai Mathai. She loves golf, don't you, Dr. Wangarai Mathai?
I love golf, and I love to watch it. Now, I can hardly play. I once tried, but I spent more time in the bush looking for my ball. So right now, I'm out.
You can plant a lot of trees around a golf course, that's for sure.
That's right, I do that.
You're listening to The Takeaway with Todd Zwillick, Femi Ok, and Dr. Wangarai Mathai and Ibrahim Abdul-Martin.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Femi Ok, sitting in for Adora Udoji. Mark Garrison has your latest news headlines, Mark.
Thank you, Femi. 12 minutes before the hour, the CIA is closing secret overseas prisons used to detain terror suspects. The so-called black sites were places where some of the most controversial interrogation techniques, such as waterboarding, were used. CIA Chief Leon Panetta also says the agency will stop using private contractors to interrogate prisoners. President Obama meets with his economic advisors a little later this morning. They'll talk about rising unemployment and the stress testing for the country's biggest banks. And the president will go to church this weekend, his first visit to a local church since joining the Oval Office. The White House is being quiet about exactly which church he'll attend on Easter Sunday. They also say he won't necessarily join this church he visits. He has not had a church home since he left his Chicago church amid the controversy over Reverend Jeremiah Wright.
Thank you very much, Mark. Thanks, Mark. Now, lately it seems that everybody has an opinion about how to deal with the problems facing Africa. But how many people have solutions that have proven to actually work? Dr. Wangarai Mathai is a Nobel Peace Prize-winning activist. She came up with a green solution. Dr. Mathai is the founder of the Green Belt Movement, which basically taught women how to make money by planting trees. You could say that she was the commander of a green revolution in Africa. Now, I want you to have a listen to Dr. Mathai taking on the authorities in Kenya, and I warn you, she's fierce.
We want honesty. We want justice. If you're going to shed blood because of our land, we will. We are used to that. Our forefathers shed blood for land. We will do so. This is my blood.
Good morning, Dr. Troublemaker. Take us back to that scene. When was it? Where was it? What was happening?
Well, that scene was, for me, that scene was at Karura Forest. For those who know Nairobi, it's a forest that kind of encircles Nairobi, or forms a semicircle around Nairobi. And it's a very old forest. It was a forest that always separated the savannas from the highlands. And it is a very, very important part of Nairobi, partly because it is the carbon sink for Nairobi. It freshens the air of Nairobi. it's a very important part of a clean and healthy environment for Nairobians.
Now, anybody who's African or who knows anything about Africa will know you because you were the first Nobel laureate from the African continent, the first female Nobel laureate. So you're extremely famous. But there are people out there who don't know your work. And a good introduction is a film that's coming out on PBS, and that's on April the 14th. It's called Taking Root, The Vision of Wangari Maathai, a documentary that premieres next week. How long did it actually take you to film that documentary?
Well, I want to pay a tribute to Alan and Lisa, a couple from Vermont, who actually tried very, very hard to capture the story for almost 5 years. They started before the prize and had to start all over again over the prize. So they really paid a lot of attention to the story and tried to understand the story behind the story. And I therefore think that they have done justice, and will help people to understand the many challenges that people face in Africa.
I just want to emphasize that you are a huge celebrity, and you get followed around all over the world, and people come up to you and hug you. Ibrahim was just shaking your hand; he was really honored to actually meet you. How does it feel then to take all of that adoration on and then see it in a documentary? How comfortable were you with what they put together?
Well, I'm quite comfortable to talk about my experiences and to narrate the story. But sometimes it's uncomfortable looking at a film and looking at myself. That I'm not used to.
You also have a book out, so you're seriously doing some branding here. Your book is called The Challenge for Africa. Now, as I was talking about a little bit earlier on, a lot of people are talking about Africa. How do we fix Africa? What is different about your angle that you're taking?
I have a special angle because, first of all, I'm an African, and I have been in Africa working at the grassroots level, working with the people, trying to face these challenges. And the book is a reflection of how I have tried to understand these challenges and deal with them, and to a certain extent offer suggestion on what I think we should be doing in order to help Africa get out of the stereotype that we now have in the world of poverty, underdevelopment, and such.
Well, I've got the book here, and it's, let me just go through it, because I was reading it just the other day. It is, how many pages are we looking at? Over 300 pages long. So it's going to be mean of me to ask you to be as specific about challenges, because everybody talks about challenges, African solutions for African problems, blah, 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 blah. Be a little bit more specific. Where do you think that Africans can actually fix Africa?
Well, some of the issues that I raise that are usually not discussed are the issue of tribe, which in this book I refer to as micronationality. And the idea is we need to recognize that we are micronations. The tribes, what we refer to as tribes, are micronations, that we need to accept each other. We need to understand each other, that we are not one, we cannot melt overnight. But we need to embrace each other and then work towards accepting that we have to create a state. We need to accept that the states we now have are superficial state created by superpowers about 100 years ago, non-negotiations by the African people, and part of the problems that we are still dealing with is because of that superficiality of the state and the fact that we see ourselves as micronations, so that our loyalty is often towards that micronation rather than to the big nation. That's one issue I deal with that I think is new and is often overlooked. The other issue that I raise is the issue of culture. And I say, is culture the missing link? Because Africans, when they were colonized, some of them were really brutally colonized. Their culture was destroyed. It was trivialized. It was demonized. And as a result, they come out of that experience cultureless, without values of their own, without traditional knowledge that they can reflect on.
And Dr. Maathai, you describe culture as being wisdom. So culture is more than just your food, your music, your dancing. It's wisdom. Let me just get onto your book in terms of a more practical sense of your book. I'm feeling it here and I'm looking at it and it looks like it's recycled paper.
Precisely. Of course, because we are environmentalists, we also embrace the concept of reuse, reduce, recycle. So we are very conscious of the fact that we want to protect the environment. We want to especially to protect the trees. So we asked our publisher, Pantheon, if they could come up with the recycled paper, and they did. Thank you very much.
Now, it's all about you in the next couple of weeks. We've got April the 14th, which is when your documentary, Taking Root, The Vision of Wangarai Maathai, is out. That's all about your background, your history. Your book is coming out on April the 14th as well. Do you feel this pressure to keep producing material all of the time?
Well, I think in many ways this is a wonderful coincidence because the two projects...
Really?
Yeah, the two projects we're running, is the truth.
Yeah, you're pulling my leg.
Not at all. The two projects were running parallel. As I say, the film has been going on for the last 5 years, and it just happened that the film was ready, the book was ready, and both of them came out at about the same time. And so I came here to the United States in order to participate in the launching and to encourage people to read, because I do think that people who want to understand Africa, who want to understand some of the challenges that we are facing, who think they can help us, need to read this book.
That is Dr. Wangarai Maathai. She's the Nobel Peace Prize winner and the author of a new book called The Challenge for Africa. Now, we've been talking this morning about media coverage of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Last weekend, the media covered the return of a soldier to the Dover Air Force Base. It was the first time the ceremony was open to reporters in 18 years. The Pentagon decided to lift its ban on media coverage of war dead in February. So we wanted to know, how does a visual image change your view of warfare? Do you think that seeing the caskets makes the war more palpable?
We tend to focus on the financial cost of war when this policy is in place, but to downplay the human cost of war.
That's Kathleen Hall Jamieson. She's the director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Tell us what you think. 877-8-MY-TAKE on MyTake at thetakeaway.org. And here's your takeaway.
There's a real conversation going on here in Baltimore about how do you use this money to really stimulate a local economy as opposed to just giving people temporary jobs that are over in a year.
That's Mark Steiner, host of The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA in Baltimore. He's talking about how the stimulus money could affect local communities. Did you miss any of our segments? Go to thetakeaway.org. I have been joined this day by Todd Zwillick.
Go, go, Todd Zwillick!
Thank you, Femi.
I'm Femi OK. Thank you so much for joining us, Todd. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.